I will do as I've done each time and begin with a brief passage of Scripture. And then we'll turn our attention to God's other book. Hebrews 11, verse 3 says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that the things which are made, or seen, pardon me, were not made of things which are visible." Now that's a passage that deserves some analysis. That's not really our purpose for today. But it does make the fundamental point we've tried to make throughout this series, and that is any position on origins that you take is a position of faith. For lots of reasons, not the least of which is no one was there to observe it directly and to do some kind of scientific investigation with regard to it. So any position on origins is ultimately a position of faith. And certainly this book teaches that our position as creationists is a position of faith. We can learn that also from examining the natural world. Glad you're here. Let's get right at the subject at hand. I have entitled this topic, "The Argument from Complexity." And the reason for that is it's based on, in large part, a book that I will be referring to throughout this lesson by Michael Behe, a biochemist. Thank you very much. We're back to chemistry again, folks. My favorite subject. Darwin's Black Box. I was privileged to meet Dr. Behe not too long ago at the University of South Florida in a lecture that he did and get him to sign his newest edition of Darwin's Black Box, 10 years after the original one came out. And in the back of this edition is an addendum, an appendix, basically, that says nothing's really changed in 10 years except that the picture for evolution has gotten worse from the biochemical evidence. So, we will be referring to this book, and the complexity of the biochemical makeup of living things is really the thrust of our discussion this afternoon. While we're at it, I'll recommend one other good book that's relatively recent in copyright date. It's called What Darwin Didn't Know. Very similar to Darwin's Black Box. This one has a copyright date of, 2004, written by Dr. Jeffrey Simmons, M.D., and basically it's a discussion of living the human body and every system in the human body. And I think you will be absolutely fascinated what Darwin didn't know. And the basic thesis of this book is, had he known what we know just about the human body, he never would have come up with his theory. I think that is true also about the biochemical evidence of life, which Darwin had not one clue about, folks. The things we know about that have really developed since 1953. So in the last 50 years, we've uncovered a whole new world that to Darwin was a black box, and thus the title of that book. All right. So let's see what we've got here. As we've said all the way through this series, there are really only two answers to where these things came from. These living things with their amazingly complex biochemical systems. They either came about by natural means, the evolutionary process, reductionism if you like, that says everything in nature can be reduced to simple enough steps that nature by itself could have done it. That's reductionism. Complex organs then arose from simpler things in small steps by natural causes is the basic evolutionary view. The creation view, the intelligent design view, is the complex organs could not have arisen without intelligent design. And the question you have to ask yourself is, which of those is more reasonable? So let's begin, as we have in most of these lectures, with a quote from Darwin's Origin of Species, this little book that none of you have read, that I asked you about the other day. I think you should read it if you want some foundational information about this topic. And as I said to you before, one of Darwin's interesting techniques in this book is that he criticizes his own theory. In fact, a great portion of this book is critiquing his own theory and then telling you why the critique is not anything you need to worry about. He does it in this as well, as you will see. So here's a quote. "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications. You get that? That's Darwinism at its core. Numerous successive slight modifications. Small changes over long periods of time. That's Darwinism. So he says, if you could come up with any complex organ that could not possibly have been formed that way, my theory would absolutely break down. Isn't that good? I mean, he just tells you, if you want to undermine my theory, here's how you can do it. Well, I suggest, let's get at it. Let's do it. I appreciate Darwin's honesty about it. So let me give you this illustration, which comes straight from Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. He presents the story of a man having a yard and his neighbors down the way a little bit, and there's a ditch between their yards. And one day he comes out into his yard, and there's his neighbor in his yard. He says, "How'd you get here?" He said, "I just jumped over the ditch." He said, "Well, jump back over and get back in your own yard." And if the ditch were that size, that's probably not a problem for you to accept. What if the ditch were that big? Well, maybe he's a pretty good long jumper. What if the ditch were that big? Maybe about 13 feet across. I think you'd say to him, "I want to see you do that." He says, "Well, I'm an Olympic long jumper." So maybe he could take a running jump and jump over that thing. And then maybe you'd believe that that's how he got into your place. But what if the ditch were this big? I don't know how well you can see that, but that's the Grand Canyon, folks. And that's what was between your yard and his. He said, "Oh, I just jumped over." He said, "Uh-huh." It becomes a stretch of the imagination, does it not? So then he is a rather brilliant neighbor, and he says to you, "No, I didn't make that in one leap, you see. What I did was I leaped from one place to a butte, and then to another butte, and then to another butte, and one right after the other, till I got all the way across." And you look over there and you say, "I don't see all those buttes." And he says, "Well, after I jumped from one to the other, this one just eroded away, and it's not there anymore. As were most of the others. They're just not there anymore." But that's how it happened. I think you'd probably change the subject to baseball or something, because, I mean, that kind of stretches the imagination too, doesn't it? And that's his illustration as he begins his book. He says, in Darwin's day, if someone said this evolved from that, with his black box mentality, he didn't know how complex those things were, he might well say, "Oh, well, that was a reasonable leap." But what we have learned in recent times, folks, is that those things that Darwin thought it might have been a 6-foot ditch are Grand Canyons! Everywhere you look is a Grand Canyon! How'd you get from here to there? Well, it's a Grand Canyon. Because we now know the biochemistry that's underneath it all. And you can forget talking about the outward appearance of things. Explain to me the chemistry. You tell me how the chemistry came about by Darwin's mechanism. Forget the eyeball. Let's look down inside it. And that's where we're headed today. So hang on. Darwin on the eye, right after he got through saying, "Well, if you could show me one complex organ." Well, he talked about the human eye. Wouldn't that be one of the first things you pick? Here's a complex organ. Tell me how this eyeball, this functioning eye, came about by little steps over long periods of time. So he brings it up himself. To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus for different distances, you are aware, aren't you, that your eye automatically focuses in and out? If you want to read this, your eye just automatically focuses, except mine doesn't work anymore, so I have to put that on. But it does. and for admitting different amounts of light. You know, don't you, of course, that if the light is dimmed, your eye automatically opens up and allows more light in, and vice versa. And for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, did you know your eye makes some automatic corrections for some imperfections there? That this could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest possible degree. You see, he's doing it again, isn't he? He's saying it for you. And then he proceeds to tell you why he believes the eye evolved anyway. And here's how he does it. I want you to follow his reasoning. Yet reason tells me that if numerous gradations from a perfect and complex eye to one very imperfect and simple, each grade being useful to its possessor, can be shown to exist. How about it, class? Would you agree with me that in nature you can find different kinds of eyes, some much more complex than others, some much simpler than others? Well, yes, you can. That's his first point. If further the eye does vary ever so slightly, how about it, class? Would you agree that the eye varies ever so slightly from person to person? I think so. And the variations be inherited? Are variations sometimes inherited? Well, certainly they are, which is certainly the case, he says. And if any variation or modification in the organ be ever useful to an animal under changing conditions of life, do you think some of those variations are ever useful to an animal under changing conditions? I think so. I think you'd have to answer yes to all those questions. Then he would say, then the difficulty of believing that a perfect and complex eye could have been formed by natural selection, though insuperable to our imagination, can hardly be considered real. Let me try to walk you through this. This is Darwin's reasoning. And folks, it's the same kind of reasoning over and over again in his book that really convinced the intellectual world that Darwinism is an acceptable explanation for the origin of life and the origin of the variety of species. Let's see if I can walk you through this. Jellyfish have simple photoreceptors for eyes. Did you know that? Up here on the surface of the jellyfish, there's just a little photosensitive spot. That's about all it is. What that means is that spot responds to light. And that's about it. It's sensitive to light. When light strikes it, it sends signals down into the jellyfish. That's about it. It's a simple photoreceptor. All right, I'm teaching you a class, folks. You're at Harvard University. Sitting under Stephen Jay Gould, evolutionary professor. Here's what he'd say to you. We have in nature simple eyes like this. All they are is photoreceptors. We don't have to be too concerned about how a photoreceptor works. It's so simple, nature could have produced that. So we've got those kinds of eyes. It is entirely reasonable to propose that the very first types of eyes that evolved were simple photoreceptors. That's all. And one can imagine that photoreceptors evolved. It's not that difficult for us to imagine that, because they're very simple. Now, also in nature you will find limpets. Limpets have cupped eyes, ladies and gentlemen. And were we to go into this in some detail, I would show you in great detail the cupped eye of a limpet. Here's basically what it is. It's a photoreceptor in a dip. That's it. Instead of this, it's this. Now, do you have difficulty imagining that some creature might evolve from a photoreceptor on this kind of a surface to one on this kind of a surface? All you've got is a cup that developed. Would there be some selective advantage to having an eyeball that has cupped and the photoreceptor at the base of the cup? Well, yes, there would be. It helps to focus the light instead of just any old light hitting it. Only light that's focused upon it will hit it. That has some selective advantage. So why can't you believe, along with me, that a creature evolved in little small stages from one that had a photoreceptor like this to one that had a photoreceptor like that? That's easy. Small steps, just little changes. Now we've got an eye that's in a cup. And such eyes exist, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe that was the next stage in the development of complex eyes. Then you have snails. And Darwin knew about all these creatures. Snails have eyes also. But their eyes, look, they have cupped eyes with photoreceptive cells in the back with a little lens over the top. Very simple. Now, can't you imagine with me that over a series of small steps, a creature could have evolved that has a little bit, slightly bit of a protrusion here. It's kind of like a lens that has a little advantage because it helps focus the light. And then, as those protrusions, maybe in some cases they're a little bit larger for one creature than the other, and that's favored. And so, they produce offspring that have a little larger ones, and eventually maybe even one that comes all the way over. So you now have a cupped eye with a lens. And the idea that that could have happened by small steps, little changes, gradual progression, so now you have an eye with a lens. You see? Very simple. And do we have eyes like that in nature? Yes, we do. So why can't you believe, along with me, that complex eyes gradually evolved through these various stages of eyes to where we have more complicated eyes, maybe like the fruit fly's compound eye or the honeybee's compound eye and simple eyes at the top, or even the eagle eye eventually, and eventually our eyes? But you have to go through very many stages of small changes over long periods of time. That's Darwin's argument. Now be honest with yourself. Is that pretty convincing type of reasoning? Some say no, some say yes. Well, I can tell you it convinced an awful lot of folks. And he applied that not just to eyes, but any complex organ you want to think of. And you remember the book I mentioned to you the other day, The Blind Watchmaker by Richard Dawkins? Richard Dawkins takes Darwin's reasoning to another level. He is the ultimate reductionist. He says, look, there isn't anything you can bring up in living things that I can't break down into a small enough step that anybody would believe nature could do that by itself. All you got to do is break it down, reduce it to small enough steps, and it can happen naturally, and then add up over time. He would say, look, people, 5% vision is better than no vision, isn't it? 6% vision is better than 5%. 7% is better than 6%, and right on up the scale. So why can't you believe that eyes evolved by small changes over long periods of time? And I would say to you, Darwin was in some senses forgivable when he reasoned that way. But Richard Dawkins is not. He ought to be whipped because he ought to know better. Even Darwin's reasoning, however, ladies and gentlemen, is flawed because we don't know that snails' eyes evolved from limpet eyes. We don't know that. And by the way, we know now that snails' eyes and limpets' eyes are a whole lot more complicated than Darwin ever dreamed. And by the way, jellyfish photoreceptors are extremely complicated at the biochemical level. Don't tell me, I don't care how a photoreceptor evolved. You better care. A photoreceptor is a highly complex chemical system. Just that one little step, folks, is a Grand Canyon. It's not a 6-foot ditch. So let's get at the real issue here and quit mamby-pambying around about this. You explain to me the chemistry of seeing. Then we'll talk. You tell me how that happened by small steps over long periods of time. You see, we're not in Darwin's black box anymore with regard to the chemistry of life. Much of it has been unfolded since the 1950s. Do you think we're there yet? Folks, there is so much more we have to learn, and the more we learn, the more complex it gets. It's unbelievable how complicated it is. And yet it all works together like a finely tuned machine. You see, irreducibly complex, according to Dr. Behe, means a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of those parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. Let me correct his English. To effectively cease functioning. You shouldn't split infinitives. Even yet. Do you get what he means by an irreducibly complex system? It's something that has lots of parts to it, and if you take one part out, it stops working. And what he says is, you find that kind of system everywhere you look. He deals with eight systems like that in his book. You could multiply that by 1,000. Everywhere you look, you have irreducibly complex systems in living things. Let's talk about the biochemistry of vision. You see, we don't just see the eyeball now. Darwin knew most everything that's on that screen. He knew a lot of those parts in the eye. He knew about the cornea and the lens and the iris and the capsule of the lens, the anterior chamber. He knew about the vitreous body in here. He knew about this layer back at the back of the eye, which we call the what? The retina. He knew about that layer and that it receives the light. And we know that that retina receives the light signal, takes it down here to the optic nerve, which sends that message to the brain. He knew a lot about a lot of that stuff. But see, we don't just know this now. You see this little thin kind of purple layer back here that's the retina? We can blow that thing up, magnify it. There is the retina. Magnified many times. And what we know it contains is bipolar neurons, rods and cones, and ganglion cells all hooked in together in a particular order and sequence. But see, we don't just look at that. We can go down inside and we look at the rods and cones magnified considerably larger than that. And here are the bipolar neurons. Can you see how this whole thing is magnified again? And we can see it now. But that's not all. You see, one of those rod cones, there it is magnified again. There's one single rod cone. Do you see that's a major cell? It's got a nucleus here, Golgi bodies, mitochondria, and then it's got these discs up here. Interesting. These discs. And down here is the synaptic body. That's just one rod cell out of that thing you saw a while ago. But see, that's not all. We can take this little piece of it right here and magnify it again, and that's what this is. You see? So you can take these discs here and this little piece of it and magnify it again. We're down to 0.5 micrometers now. We can see it with our devices we have at our disposal. But that's not all, folks. We can take this little piece of the disc up here and we know what it looks like. And not only that, we know what the chemistry is that's going on inside those discs that allow you to be able to see. So you see, this is not a black box anymore, where Darwin could only see the eyeball, and he could probably be forgiven that he didn't have a clue how complicated all this was. Let's talk a little bit about that, and folks, what are we back to? Chemistry. Chemistry is life. Life is chemistry. Alright, so here's what we're going to be looking at. This system here. Now remember, this is that one little piece out of that disc, and there's a bunch of those in here. This is a system, and you see this membrane here that runs along the outside? This is the membrane, and it has channels in it. And over here are these disc membranes that have parts to it that I'm going to describe to you next. So here we go. There are those disc membranes. Here's the membrane out here, the external membrane. Here's the channel here, this particular one. And here's the chemistry that takes place in there. So are you ready? I'm going to read you a little chemistry. We go to Dr. Behe's book on page 18. Now listen, when I get through with this, I'm not giving you a test. And I don't expect you to remember it. What I expect you to do is be overwhelmed with the magnificence of it. So you listen well enough that you get the picture of how complex this is. And let me start by making an apology to every neural disc inside every eyeball. Because when I get finished, I will have done a miserably incomplete job of explaining to you what all is happening. What I'm going to be telling you is just one tiny part of the entire system that must take place for you to be able to see. So please understand, I've offered my apology ahead of time. What I'm going to describe to you is just one minuscule piece of the whole picture. It's enough, though. When light first strikes the retina, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis-retinal, which rearranges within picoseconds to transretinal. You know what a picosecond is? He describes it here. It's the time it takes light to travel the breadth of a single human hair. Anybody know the speed of light? 186,000 miles per second. And it's the time it would take that to go over one hair. So that's not very long, is it? All right, so when light first strikes the retina, which is the backside of your eyeball, a photon interacts with a molecule called 11-cis-retinal, and it changes to 11-trans-retinal. All it does is change the geometric structure of that chemical. And they give a little picture here. The cis looks like this, the trans looks like that. Now, it really doesn't look like that. It changes structure in picoseconds. So, you with me so far? The change in shape of the retinal molecule forces a change in the shape of the protein rhodopsin, right there. See rhodopsin? To which retinal is tightly bound. The protein's metamorphosis alters its behavior. Now called metarhodopsin 2, the protein sticks to another protein called transducin. Right there. This one sticks to that one. Before bumping into metarhodopsin 2, transducin has tightly bound a small molecule called GDP. But when transducin interacts with metarhodopsin 2, the GDP falls off and the molecule GTP, which binds to transducin. GTP is closely related to critically different from GTP. GDP and GTP are different. Slightly different. Very important. The GTP transducin metarhodopsin 2 now binds to a protein called phosphodiesterase, right there, PDE, located in the inner membrane of the cell. When attached to metarhodopsin 2 in its entourage, the phosphodiesterase acquires the chemical ability to cut a molecule called cGMP, right there, a chemical relative to both GDP and GTP. Sounds like it, doesn't it? cGMP is close to GDP and GTP. Initially, there are a lot of cGMP molecules in the cell. A lot of these. See it over here? But the phosphodiesterase lowers its concentration just as a pulled plug lowers the water level in the bathtub. And the water goes in. Well, how did all that happen? Well, you have this entourage here that causes cGMP to turn into 5-GMP, and thus you reduce the concentration of this stuff. So far, so good. Another membrane protein that binds cGMP is called an ion channel, right here. It acts as a gateway that regulates the number of sodium ions into the cell. There's sodium. It also regulates the number of calcium ions that go in and out. When the amount of CGMP is reduced because of the cleavage of the phosphodiesterase, the ion channel closes, causing the cellular concentration of positively charged sodium ions to be reduced. The amount of this stuff goes down because this ion closes when that happens. Look, are you getting the picture that this is one thing that depends on another thing that depends on another thing that depends on another thing? You getting that picture? It's called a cascade of reactions. You know how long those reactions take? Picoseconds! Happen very quickly. When the amount of CGMP is reduced because of the cleavage, it causes cellular concentration of positive charge ions to be reduced. This causes an imbalance of charge across the cell membrane that finally causes a current to be transmitted down the membrane to the optic nerve and eventually to the brain. Now, what I haven't told you is the chemistry behind all of that. And what happens when that signal gets to the brain and it translates it? Ladies and gentlemen, it takes an electrical signal and it translates it so you see 3D color. As you're seeing right now. You have no clue what's going on while you're sitting there watching me. It is a complex set of reactions that are absolutely unbelievably complex. And like I said, I haven't touched the hem of the garment. All right, look. If what I've just described to you is all that happened, you'd go blind in a matter of very short time. You'd be blind. Because you would be losing rhodopsin, phosphodiesterase, CGMP, and you'd upset this charge balance across that membrane. If you kept going that way, you'd go blind. You don't have an infinite amount of that stuff. So you know what has to happen? It has to reverse itself. Now, do you want to hear all about that? I don't think so. But it's another set of complex reactions that take it backwards. I'll at least show you the picture here. See, this shows you both cycles. What I have described to you is the forward cycle here that closes that ion channel and causes the imbalance. What has to happen almost instantly is a reverse reaction that involves GTP and guanylate cyclase. Now, I'm going to test your memory. When something ends in ASE, what is it? It's an enzyme, which is a protein. Thank you very much. Did you know this is another one of the specialized proteins that does one specific job in your body? And if it's not there, you'd be blind? This one activates the reverse reaction to replace 5-GMP with CGMP, which then in turn opens channels back up, which depolarizes and does all that stuff backwards. So you get back free of charge most of the stuff you used up. Now I want to ask you something. Dawkins just blithely talks about 5% vision. What do you mean 5% vision? You think you could have 5% of that? People, you take out one piece of that process and you see nothing! Either forward or backward. It's irreducibly complex. So how do you allow that to evolve? Small steps over long periods of time. Okay, so your body produces some phosphodiesterase. You're not seeing anything. There's no 5% vision there, people. What do you mean 5% vision? That's a ridiculous statement. 5% vision. You either see or you don't see. Think about it. He's trying to reduce something you can't reduce. That's the problem. So Darwin said, if you can find me one complex organ that could not possibly have been produced by small, successive, slight modifications, my theory absolutely breaks down. I suggest to you, his theory is broken. Just by this. We haven't even started. I told you, this is only one part of the story for the eye. It's much more complicated than this. And the interesting thing about it is all the other things that are going on all work together with this one, which by itself is enough. They all work together to make you be able to see. It's absolutely overwhelming. Somebody made this, people. Somebody made it. That's the only reasonable explanation. What about blood clotting? That's another thing he discusses in his book. We'll make this one relatively brief. Blood clotting. Have you ever watched this happen? That was on my knee at one time. I mean, that's not my knee, actually, but it's, you know, it was a basketball accident. I got knocked down and skidded across the floor and ripped my knee wide open. I hope none of you are real squeamish here. But this is what happens if your body is allowed to heal itself. Isn't that amazing? Your body just does it. You haven't the slightest notion what's going on. Blood clotting is a magnificently complicated event. And you know what else about it that has to happen? Are there ever problems with clots? Is that a difficult thing sometimes? A bad thing? Why, yeah. How about heart attacks? How about strokes? You get clots in the wrong place, you're in big trouble. So this clotting system that your body partakes in has to happen when it's needed, how it's needed, how long it's needed, and it better stop. Or you're in a heap of trouble. Do you ever think about that? There's how it happens. Of course, you can explain that thoroughly. You can understand exactly what's going on, right? Folks, do you see another cascade of reactions here? There is an intrinsic pathway and an extrinsic pathway for blood clotting. If there's some kind of a trauma, damaged surface, immediately both of these start in your body. And there's a series of reactions that happen, one depending on the other, and you see here they come together, and then they form more reactions till finally down here you get a cross-linked fibrin clot. I can describe to you the chemistry. I can tell you the chemistry of how you get a cross-linked fibrin clot from fibrin. I want you to notice something. Do you see all these Roman numerals up here? Guess what each one of those represents? You know the answer in one word. Proteins! There are 13 different specific proteins required for this process. Each does its own particular task. What do you call a person whose blood does not clot very well? A hemophiliac. Did you know, folks, that hemophiliacs are people who have one part of this that doesn't function right? One little piece. One of these things is called the Christmas factor. It's an interesting, it's kind of like a gift from God. Well, if there isn't enough Christmas factor right here at this step, you don't clot. You take out one piece, it doesn't clot. There are two major types of hemophiliacs. Each one of them involves one piece out of this cascade. You take out one piece that doesn't function properly, nothing works, your blood doesn't clot. That's a bad deal, isn't it? This is a good deal. And it works beautifully. And did you know if this is all that happened, you would clot to death in 5 minutes? Guess what has to happen? A reverse reaction has to take place, which is just as complicated as that, to stop the clotting when you get enough clotting. And so it's done very sensitively, so the clot's enough, but not too much to kill you. I'll tell you, folks, I look at that and I say, it looks to me like somebody designed that. For me to think that that complex cascade of reactions that involves blood clotting took place in humans and a number of other mammalian-type creatures, you tell me that happened by small steps over a long period of time. Folks, in the meantime, the thing bled to death! It doesn't work until it's all there. That's what he means by irreducibly complex. And you know what the evolutionists say about that? They say that's ridiculous. This thing can evolve in steps because at one point this step did some other job that was useful for the organism, and it didn't do all these jobs. They didn't do all these steps. The stages maybe for a period of time did something else. That doesn't help me any. In the meantime, I bled to death. That doesn't answer anything. What you got to answer is, how did this process get started before the organism died? The immune system. I want you to watch. This is a kind of a pictorial description of what happens to cancer cells if your body's working right. There's a cancer cell, and these are the T cells. I'm telling you, they are the mighty artillery. And they come after this cancer cell, and they suck him dry. See, there's the cancer cell. He's worse for the wear. And here are the T cells that have taken the very life out of this thing. And here's how it ends up. This poor cancer cell ends up as a bunch of strung out. He looks like he's been stressed out. There's nothing left of him. Listen, your immune system is one of the most powerful things there is. It's unbelievable what it does. And of course, trying to describe it in the next few minutes is very challenging. So it'll be a very quick treatment of something I hope just teases you enough to get in there and find out what your immune system's really like. Unbelievable. So look, here are our enemies, the pathogens. Brother Delk knows all about these because he works in this field. Fighting pathogens. Did you know, folks, that you are in a constant war? Every single second of every day you're in war. And you better be aware of it and do everything you can to protect yourself from it. It reminds me of what the Lord says in Scripture. You know, we're in a war constantly, aren't we? Spiritual war, and you better have your armor on. Well, the Lord has provided you some pretty good armor with the immune system, and it starts right here with your skin. That's your first line of defense. Did you know that's the largest organ you have? I'd like to present it to Darwin. Your skin. It's an amazing organ, and it keeps most enemies out. The problem is you have some places in your body that doesn't have skin. And a few others. Please guard those places very carefully. What you allow in the various openings of your skin is a dangerous world. But the skin, let me just tell you just briefly, the skin, did you know it has on it substances? Guess what? Give me the name. Proteins, thank you. Did you know it has on your skin some proteins that chop up viruses? You probably didn't know that. Take good care of your skin. Why is it good to chop up viruses? Because once you chop them up, they can't kill you. So your skin has built into it. It's kind of like, you remember around a city they used to build a big old, what? Moat, for one thing, but then the wall itself. And then on top of the wall, they'd sometimes put these big old spikes so it would keep people from getting in. Well, you can think of your skin like that. It's like a wall, but it also has spikes on top. That's some of these chemicals that bump off enemies before they ever get in. It's a wonderful thing. Much more could be said about that. But once the enemy invades the inside and gets in your bloodstream, he ain't seen nothing yet. Because now comes out the big artillery. And your immune system has four major purposes. Purpose number one, identify the enemy. You don't want to be killing yourself, right? You want to know who the enemy is and who he is not. So you have a system. That's called this system, the humoral immunity system. It produces antibodies. You've heard of it? The antibodies are the identifiers. Not the only ones, but they are a primary identifier of bad guys. And I want to talk to you about that a little bit. The second line of defense here is the T lymphocytes. They're the T cells. They're the big artillery. Look, when T lymphocytes get a hold of an infected cell, they blow it up! Literally. Boom! They're the big artillery. And then down here are the helper T lymphocytes, the lymphokines. And the best way I can describe that from biblical terminology is they are the Barnabases of the cell. Remember what Barnabas was? Called the son of consolation or exhortation or encouragement. These T lymphocytes have the sole purpose in life of encouraging these other two guys to do their jobs better. Say, come on, boys! That's basically their job. I wish I had time to tell you the chemistry of every one of those. It would be well worth your time. We don't have the time to do all of that. Let's do a little bit of it. Let's look at the humoral immunity system. Here are your B lymphocytes. You know those are made in your spinal column? B lymphocytes. Whoops. They call them B cells. And these B cells, when they're originally made, for the most part, have connected to them little antibodies. You see that right there? And they're connected because that way this antibody is tied to the nucleus of that cell, which can give it instructions. When this B lymphocyte attaches to an enemy, it starts changing instantly into a plasma cell. This cell changes into that kind of a cell, and folks, it becomes a veritable factory of antibodies. And guess what kind of antibody it produces? The very kind that was needed to identify that enemy. And that's the only one it produces. It'll produce that antibody to attack or to identify that particular enemy. And so it becomes this humongous plasma cell that starts spitting out antibodies at an enormous rate in, guess what, picoseconds. And it floods your bloodstream with antibodies against that particular enemy. And they go attached to the enemy. And you know what their purpose is? Here he is! Come get him! That's what those are for. Let me blow that up just a little bit. Here's the process. Here's the B cell. Antigens coming along. They get attached. Start reproducing themselves. Developed into a plasma cell. And what I didn't tell you about is this. Not only does this original B cell develop into a plasma cell, it also produces a memory cell at the same time. You know the average lifespan of a B cell in your body? About how long a B cell survives? About a day and a half. That's why you have to constantly be producing B cells in your spine. But once a memory cell is produced, guess how long that stays in your body? The rest of your life. So you know what that does for you? As an adult, you have a bunch of memory cells floating around in there, and if they ever see that enemy again, aha, I know you! Come get him! That's why adults tend not to get sick with some things as much as kids do. Because your immune system has built into it a process for developing memory cells. And they never forget that enemy. Isn't that neat? Does that sound like a plan? It sure does to me. I know, they say it evolved. I don't believe it. All right, so there it is, blown up a little. The plasma cell produces antibodies at an amazing rate. The memory cell starts floating around looking for that specific enemy from then on the rest of your life. Now, here's an antibody. I want to show you this a little bit because a second thing that your immune system needs to be able to do is not only identify the enemy, but it needs to produce a diversity of enemy identifiers. Because you think you have lots of enemies? Think of Carl Sagan. Billions and billions. You have lots of enemies. So your body needs somehow to be able to identify different kinds of enemies. Notice the antibody. It's got two long chains called the heavy chains and two short chains called the light chains. And do you see up here the binding sites? That's where they attach to the enemy. Those binding sites are very specific. An antibody will only bind to certain things. So look, an antibody is specific to a particular kind of enemy. So if you've got billions of enemies, guess how many antibodies you need? Billions of antibodies. So does your body have a mechanism in its immune system for developing billions of antibodies? Yes, it does. Let's see if I can show you that. There's a schematic diagram of the B cell. Here are the stem cells being produced down in your spine. And they produce a variety of different kinds of B cells. And that's what I want to explain to you in just a minute. How does it get this variety of B cells with all different identifiers? I'm going to show you how that happens in just a second. But look, This one will pick up that particular enemy. This one will too. Maybe this one will pick up a different kind of enemy. But look, once that one picks up that kind of an enemy, it will produce that particular antibody by the billions very quickly on determinant number 4. This is determinant number 2, and it builds its own kind of antibodies. You see? How do we get that diversity? Here's how we do it. The heavy chain antibody comes out of, there are clusters in your DNA that produce it. There's one cluster in the DNA that can give you one out of 250 different possibilities. There's another that gives you one out of 10 possibilities. There's a third that gives you one out of 6 possibilities. And then if you do some recombination jiggles, you can get another 100 factor. So altogether, that gives you 250 times 10 times 6 times 100, or 1,500,000 combinations for the heavy chain. But what else do you have in an antibody besides a heavy chain? A light chain. So the antibody light chain, by a similar process, yields about 10,000 different combinations. So together, the heavy chain and the light chain genes together give you a grand total of 1,500,000 times 10,000, or 15 billion combinations built into your DNA to do nothing but produce antibodies. You see why DNA is pretty important? And do you see why I say to somebody, tell me that came about by natural means? And we haven't begun to tell you what DNA does, folks. We haven't begun. This is just to build antibodies. And you can get 15 billion different types of antibodies. That's enough to cover our enemies. Thank goodness. It is amazing. Now, this is just the humoral part, the B-cell part. Once you get the enemy identified, there he is, come get him. Then you have to get the T cells into effect, and that requires the complement pathway. Does this look familiar? It's a cascade of reactions. Do you see that? One depends on the next one, depends on the next one, depends on the next one. It gets a little boring after a while because everywhere you look, that's what you've got. And it's not till you get over here you kill the enemy, people. This one depends on that one, depends on that one, depends on that one, depends on that one, depends on that one. I'm wearing you out, I can tell. You're fading out. But I want to tell you, even while you're fading out, that's working. And if it weren't, you'd be dead. Don't you take this for granted. That's the T cell part, and the helper lymphocytes I've already described to you. So look, we've talked about the biochemistry of vision, blood clotting, the immune system. We haven't done justice to any of them, but I hope you've gotten enough information to show you these are magnificently complex biochemical systems in which if you remove one piece, the whole thing falls apart, and it's all working together in cascades of reactions at picoseconds. Every second you've been sitting there, 10 million things just happened. And by the way, when I scream, it makes it worse. Because things happen about that, too. For one thing, you can't stay asleep. And so at the end of his book, here's what Behe says. These scientific obstacles serve as stark examples of the mountains and chasms that block a Darwinian explanation of life. It's like the Grand Canyon everywhere you look. And folks can say, oh, well, that happened by I jumped from one butte to another and then they disappeared. That's about the best they can do. And if you want to believe that, I have a bridge I can sell you. The result of these cumulative efforts to investigate the cell, to investigate life at its molecular level, is a loud, clear, piercing cry of design. And by the way, Behe capitalized that and put an exclamation point after it. I didn't do that. The result is so unambiguous and so significant that it must be ranked as one of the greatest achievements in the history of science. The discovery rivals those of Newton and Einstein, Lavoisier and Schrodinger, Pasteur and Darwin. The observation of the intelligent design of life is as momentous as the observation that the Earth goes around the sun, or that disease is caused by bacteria, or that radiation is emitted in quanta. The magnitude of the victory gained at such great cost through the sustained effort over the course of decades would be expected to send champagne corks flying in labs around the world. This triumph of science should evoke cries of Eureka from 10,000 throats. Should occasion much hand-slapping and high-fiving, and perhaps even an excuse to take the day off. But no bottles have been uncorked. No hand slapped. Instead, a curious, embarrassed silence surrounds the stark complexity of the cell. When the subject comes up in public, feet start to shuffle and breathing gets a bit labored. In private, people are a bit more relaxed. Many explicitly admit the obvious, but then stare at the ground, shake their heads, and let it go at that. People don't know what to do with this. It is overwhelming. Unless you're Anthony Flew, a pure evolutionist and atheist for 70 years, who finally in his 80s said, "I don't know how to answer this. There has to be a God." Some people are finally honest with themselves. I hope some of you may have some influence on somebody. Why does the scientific community not greedily embrace its startling discovery? Why is the observation of design handled with intellectual gloves? The dilemma, and I have to set this up for you. Here's this big empty room. People are on their knees going around on the floor looking for something. And right in the middle of the room is an elephant. And they're not seeing it. He says, the dilemma is that while one side of the elephant is labeled intelligent design, the other side might be labeled God. And many scientists are not going to have it. I've had them tell me, "We will not let God's foot in the door." Isn't that pitiful? It's pitiful. You mark out the only possible explanation of all these complex things we've shown you, and you try to stick with your answer, which has zero evidence to support it in this instance. But Dawkins would say to you, even if we had no evidence, it'd be better to take this position than that one. Is that prejudice? That's what Isaiah talked about when he said, "Seeing they cannot see, and hearing they cannot hear." And God forbid. That's my lesson for this afternoon. I would like to close this way. We're going to have a few questions and answers in just a minute. It is my prayer before I start such a series as this, always, that in some small way, I have opened up to the minds of as many people as I can influence the magnificence of the one who created us, because His signature is found in the earth, in the sea, and in the sky. Everywhere you look, God's signature is found if we just open our eyes and examine it. And the more fully we are privileged to see His signature, the more fully we can magnify Him, learn who He truly is, and become His faithful servants. That's my hope and prayer, that this is accomplished. And maybe you can use it to help somebody else as well. Thank you for your good attention. If there are any questions, we'll try to deal with them during this period.
You have the cards on the back of the pew in front of you. So,
here's the question. Taking the blood clotting process, for example, when evolutionists argue that each discrete step at some time in the past had some beneficial effect by itself, do they generally profess to know what those beneficiary effects were, or are they merely speculating? I can tell you, you can read the literature for yourself. It is pure and utter speculation for most of these things. they just make up stories about how this was beneficial and this was beneficial, and then by some magnificent means they somehow got together and both of them together became beneficial, and then over time the whole cascade of reactions became beneficial. It's just a bunch of stories, folks. There's not solid evidence to undergird those things. Look for yourself. One of the things Behe did was he did some consistent research through the literature, all the scientific literature on these subjects. He didn't find any explanations for how the Darwinian evolution process worked for this, though. There isn't any such thing. Now, they say, of course, they have enough faith that they believe one day somebody's going to find out. They're not giving up their view. How do evolutionists like Stephen Gould at Harvard in the I class explain that all these stages still exist? How do they justify the continuing presence of all their various stages in different species? Shouldn't their belief mean that we should all be becoming one species? Shouldn't all lower species and stages become extinct? That's an interesting question, and I never use it because it's too easy to answer. Let me answer it this way. People ask this question. Well, if we evolved from apes, why are there still apes? Right? You've heard that question. That's too easy to answer by an evolutionist. It's not a good question. Here's what they'll say to you. What happened is, from the evolutionist perspective, here was our common ancestry back there, a population of apes of some kind. And in that population of apes, some of them experienced mutational changes that allowed them to migrate or evolve along this branch. Others of them had different mutations or stayed the same and went and evolved along this branch. And so it's simply a matter of two different types of creatures evolving along two different branches. And so you end up with both of them. You see? That's not hard to answer. And that's a perfectly reasonable possible explanation for how you'd end up with both apes and humans, isn't it? If those things happen. Right. I mean, if you breed dogs, that's a good illustration. If you breed in a population of Heinz 57 variety dogs, and you breed a certain group of them to emphasize certain characteristics, like maybe you want them to have pointy ears, or maybe not as much hair, shorter hair. You're breeding them for certain characteristics. Don't you take certain ones out of the population that have a little shorter hair and emphasize that feature and breed right along through several generations? Well, aren't the other ones still here? Well, of course they are. Say it again. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's how you get the good seeing eye dog. You get the one with the certain characteristics that's able to handle that situation. Yeah, so that's not a good argument, is what I'm telling you. To say that we ought to all be evolving to one species is not a good argument. Evolutionists can answer that too easily. So be careful. I'll tell you, I've learned in debating with various ones, you make the absolute strongest arguments you can make. Don't mess with weak arguments. You're going to get slaughtered. And besides that, it destroys the good case you're trying to make. Was Ramapithecus palate really just a human palate? No. The Ramapithecus palate was interpreted by some folks as being human in shape. Well, look, you feel your palate. And it goes up like this and has certain features about it. But I guarantee you, your palate and my palate aren't exactly the same. I don't want to feel your palate. I'm sorry. But I guarantee you, yours and mine are not exactly the same. There are variations even in human palates, wouldn't you agree? But there's a general shape to human palates that are pretty consistent. And when people examine these fossils, they look at those palates and say, well, that's pretty close to human. So that's what they did with Ramapithecus until they found some fossils that they consider to be from the same species that were more complete, and they saw the other features, and they then decided, when looking at the same palate, no, that doesn't look human anymore. So do you think there's an element of interpretation there? Of course there is. Particularly if you're looking at a fossil, you can't ask him, were you human? Nor can you ask him to mate with a human and see if it works. Which is really how you define species, isn't it? Would you please, fossil, mate with this other fossil? You can't do that. So you have to just look at it. And there's a lot of interpretation that takes place. Now, look, I don't want to take away from these guys. There's a lot you can learn from examining a fossil. There is. You can learn a lot, more than you'd ever think. And if you're really careful in your measurements, you can come up with some pretty good answers. But you can also come up with a lot of mistakes, misinterpretations. When volcanic rock hardens quickly, molten lava hitting water, does it appear to be older than it really is? That's an interesting question. Volcanic rock, you know, this molten rock comes down off the island mountain and then hits the water and solidifies very quickly. The question is, does that make the rock appear to be older than it really is? I'm no geologist, but I don't think so. Because I think the properties of that rock that will determine its age are the radioactive chemicals, which themselves are not impacted by whether you cool it down quickly or not. So that's my answer. You check it out. I don't know for sure if that's the case, but I don't think cooling rock quickly is going to change the chemical content and the radioactivity of those chemicals inside it. Who came up with it? That was a long process. Did you know we didn't even know about radioactivity till the 1890s? Becquerel is given credit for being one of the first to observe the effects of radioactivity. Then it started to be studied. Do you remember who some of the famous people were that studied radioactivity in the early days, in the early 1900s? Madame Curie, of course, is given credit for doing much seminal work in that area. And a number of others that studied it. And out of that study of radioactivity came the idea that if radioactivity is a process by which a chemical changes from one element into a different element at a certain rate, the idea came, well, maybe we can use that to determine how old something is. Think with me just a minute. If you know how much of that stuff is here now in this thing, this piece of rock, you can measure how much potassium and argon are in it right now. And if you knew how much was in the rock in the beginning, whenever that was, and you know the rate at which this stuff decays into this stuff, then you know how old it is. Right? All right, here are the problems with it. You can measure how much is here now. That's no problem. How do you measure how much was there at the beginning? This is a problem. Nobody was there. And the beginning means different things depending on what kind of substance you're talking about. The beginning may mean when that rock was originally formed, however that happened. But nobody was there to measure it. So what do you have to do? You have to make an assumption that similar kinds of rock that you can observe now forming would have had the same amount of stuff in it that they did back then. Uniformitarianism is the idea. It's an assumption, folks. Second assumption is this. From here to here, did any of that radioactive stuff get out or get in by some other means? That's called the leakage assumption. If there was any leak, right, in or out, your whole clock's thrown off. And the third assumption is the rate at which it decays has always remained constant. If those three assumptions are valid, then the method's valid. I think all three of them are suspect. So it's not an absolute dating method. Who made it up were the folks who were studying radioactivity and thought about, maybe I could use this process to help date things.
They themselves acknowledge there's assumptions. You could go to any radio book and see there's assumptions.
You have to. Now, they will argue that some things, they can do some things in their experimentation to invalidate some of the problems with the assumptions.
Now, would the evolutionists disagree
on those things? No, sir. They would not disagree with what I've told you, but they would say they have great confidence in the assumptions. You have to. I mean, they would say you can't make any other assumption than uniformitarianism. Otherwise, there's no way of testing anything. You have to assume things have been the same. And, of course, if creation happened, that's not the same, is it? I mean, that's a unique event in all time, and obviously you can't use science to investigate that. But can you use science to investigate that something was designed? Yes, you can! That's what I'm getting at. There is a point where science has to get off. Science cannot investigate God. Not ultimately. But can it investigate signs of design? Yes, it can. Which point you to God. How can they... This is not written correctly. Let me see if I can make sense out of it. How can they, what kind of animal a bone? How can they know what kind of animal a bone came from? For example, a bone from a horse versus a bone from a camel. That's a good question. How do they know this bone came from a horse or a camel? Say the only thing you have is a femur bone. How can you know what kind of creature that came from? That's particularly difficult if you say that creature is extinct. You have to make up what kind of creature it came from. And that's exactly what they do, folks, with these fossils when they say, this is a new fossil species that's extinct. What do you mean? Nobody's ever seen it. It died before any of us ever survived or ever lived. And yet I'm telling you there was such a thing. Well, that's meaning its femur bone is different than anything I ever saw. So it had to be a different kind of creature. But yes, there are ways in comparative anatomy to determine... Look, detectives, forensic scientists do it all the time. They find a dead body. They find a dead animal. They find a dead something. They got to figure out what that came from. If they can, what kind of a creature was it? Oh, yes. Comparative anatomy can tell you a lot. This bone is very much like this kind of creature. I don't deny that. That's how forensic science works on all the cases. You can do the same thing with chemistry, by the way. Let me throw in another interesting fact. Did you know that from the instant of conception, you can tell if it's a male or female? Because their chemistry is different. Don't tell me women and men are alike. They are as different as their chemistry is different. And it is different. And you can tell it from conception. And a whole lot of other things are different, too. As we all learn as we get married and try to learn how to live with each other. But you know, that also was design. God knew exactly what He was doing. And my job as a husband is to figure out how to make my wife complete. And vice versa. And it's a challenge that God intended for me to have for my whole life. And if we look at that as a blessing, then marriage becomes a blessing. What a lot of folks do is they look at that as a curse. And they start fighting each other about everything. And nothing works right. That's not God's fault. That's our fault. Boy, we got off onto some other subject there, didn't we? Let's see. It made me think of something else that I wanted to say to you. This one question did. Let's see. What was it about? Well, I've forgotten it. Any other questions? Okay. All right. Go right ahead, Joe.
If this stuff like the rocks and things, they try to go back, there still seems to be, from what I hear, and I don't hear a lot of it, I mean, that there still just seems to be disagreement on age between the evolutionists. How does that happen? And
Okay, your question, I think, is do evolutionists disagree on the dates of certain fossils or rock formations?
Yeah,
there is disagreement, and that's because, maybe I should say it this way. If you're going to take a measurement, for example, of the age of a rock, it's pretty important where that rock's been. If it's been in a situation where the Earth's circumstances were very unstable, then that's not a good rock to choose to date things. So they try to choose rock formations that have been around a long time in stable circumstances, best they can tell. Because if it's been in an unstable circumstance, it could have been upheavaled and things changed. It could have been made molten instead of solid. Things that could have happened to it that could cause effects that negate your efforts to try to date it properly. So that's one thing. And so you can get different dates depending on where your samples come from. That's one of the things. Another thing is that when you take the sample measurements and you take them to different laboratories, their techniques may be a little different. And you know, it doesn't take a whole lot in an exponential equation to change the numbers quite rapidly. So the actual measuring techniques can actually vary some. So there's always a little iffiness in dates. And then I'm sure there's some other reasons as well.
For example, the carbon 14 dating, one of the major issues is the contamination from modern day carbon, just because we're all breathing out carbon dioxide with modern carbon.
Yeah.
And so that becomes a major issue with that technique.
Carbon dating is the most unreliable, because it's based on the basic stability of the amount of carbon-14 in our atmosphere, which can be impacted by a lot of things. These other methods that are longer-range methods that are inside of rocks are not as amenable to those kind of changes. But carbon-14 dating is especially amenable to problems. All right. How do evolutionists explain our spirit or conscience or emotions? First place, the evolutionists would never admit you had a spirit. No, they would say all you are is atoms in motion. You're susceptible to the same blind forces of physics. You've come about by an evolutionary process without any guidance whatsoever. You don't have a spirit. That's a figment of your imagination. Prove to me you have a spirit. You don't have a spirit. You are a human being. You are chemicals acting with the forces of nature. And your thinking is just a bunch of chemicals acting up in here that bring about a thought process. That's literally what they believe. Your conscience is just a matter of the way you happen to be thinking, and you were trained to do that from a child by a certain group of people. So there's social consciousness that you've been infected with. And you don't, you know, that's not a real entity. It's just something you've been trained to be like.
Which is why people believe we can have such a thing as artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. And we can have certain things that approach intelligence. You know that. Look, didn't the chess champion of the world get beat by a machine? He absolutely did. I never thought it had happened, but he did. Yeah, exactly. Good point. Somebody made the machine to beat the chess champion. And he built into that machine certain the characteristics of intelligence. You know what that machine does when it plays chess? It looks at the entire board and it mathematically describes every single possibility that could happen if you move this piece. Only it does it in picoseconds. And we don't have the capacity to do all that. We get worn out. But yeah, it can do all that in every single stage of the match. It's amazing. But somebody had to write the program for it to go through all those iterations, which then acts like intelligence. And nobody on earth, folks, would believe that the computer that beat whatever his name was came about by small changes over long periods of time by natural forces, the blind forces of physics.
But what else could it do?
It used, you know what they would say to you? They would say human intelligence did it, but human intelligence is part of nature, and nature produced human intelligence. And they really believe that, people. They believe that with all their hearts. How does the use of antibiotics interfere with God's design for the immune system? Ooh, that came from you, didn't it? No? How does the use of antibiotics interfere with God's design for the immune system? Well, let me speak on behalf of the drug companies. I am not a drug salesman. But the purpose of the drugs, and let's give them credit, is try to help our system when our immune system is not doing the job it could do. And the fact is, we know, and I would say it's because of the fall, that our immune system as humans doesn't function perfectly. It has some flaws in it, and the older we get, the more flaws it gets sometimes. So the drug industry is supposed to be helping our immune system when our own system doesn't function as well as it could if we were at a perfect immune system. And the drugs are designed to try to imitate some function that destroys the enemy. That's what antibiotics means. Their purpose is to destroy the enemy. Do you have time for me to tell you just a little story here? I need a board for this. because this ties in a whole bunch of things we've talked about this week. It's kind of like a summary. And if you were in my class, I would say it makes good fodder for quizzes. Hint, hint, hint. Okay? It kind of puts together a lot of the things we've talked about. And we got off on this by talking about antibiotics. So don't forget, that's where this came from. Here is a bacteria. This bacteria is killing me. And that's literal, you know that. There are bacteria that will kill you. Now, they don't kill you alone, they kill you in populations. Yeah, that's one of them. You got this population of bacteria here, and they're killing you. And your immune system somehow isn't functioning sufficiently to destroy this particular enemy. So what does the drug industry try to do? It tries to figure out a way that can put something into your bloodstream that will kill this guy and not kill you. Isn't that right? That's the point of it. To try to kill this thing selectively. It's a way to help your immune system, supposedly. Now, what the problem is with drugs is we don't often know all the other effects it can have on 16 other things that we didn't think about. Because our immune system and everything else about our system is set up in such a way that it all interfaces and all works together, and we don't understand all that. So the best we can do is try to come up with something that will kill this guy that hopefully won't kill everything else. So here's an interesting way to try to kill it. You see, this particular bacteria has a little indentation here, and in that indentation are certain things that take place for that bacteria to survive. Now, this is simplistic, you understand? So what if you design a drug that blocks that indentation? It just sits in there and blocks it up. And the fact is, there are such chemical indentations in bacteria. And you can make drugs that sit there and block that indentation. What that means then is that particular bacteria can't do what it normally does anymore, and so it dies. And all you did was block that right there, and you really didn't affect anything else, hopefully. Because what about when this dies and it just kind of bumps that off and it goes floating around in your bloodstream and it tries to block somebody else's indentation? I don't know. That's one of the problems, so you don't know what's going to happen. All right, suppose it does that and it kills that bacteria, then what you've done is you've been saved from that bacteria. And if there's enough of these guys, they can kill enough of the population that your body then can survive. That's the idea. So you take several doses of this, right, David? Now watch. This kind of fits into some of our other discussion. Is there such a thing as a beneficial mutation? People say, no, there isn't. Don't you say that. That's not correct. There are such things as beneficial mutations. And it's particularly evident in bacteria population. Because look, bacteria are simple little organisms. They're little one-celled organisms. The simplest of all organisms, basically. The mutation can take place in the DNA of that organism that, let's just say, makes that bacteria change this indentation a little bit so that it's no longer the same shape. Maybe I'll make it a little more dramatic. Okay, it looks like that now instead of like something else. There's a slight chemical change so that that indentation no longer is the same geometrically. Then when you put this medicine in there, it doesn't kill this guy. This mutated strain of bacteria is not killed by the same medicine. Has that ever happened? It's happened a lot of times. That's why we have to keep making new medicines. Because bacteria are continually mutating people. Not mutating people, mutating themselves. So that they have new strains of mutants which are not susceptible to the previous medications. And this is a very specific instance. It's a real life case. It's about penicillin. There are strains of bacteria that are they are resistant. They're not killed by penicillin anymore. So you had to make up some new medicine, didn't you? And here's one way it happened. A mutant developed a strain that had a different geometry here, so this penicillin couldn't sit on it anymore, so it's not effective in killing it. That's called a beneficial mutation, folks. You know why it's called beneficial? This guy didn't die. Would you say that's beneficial for him? I think so. I don't know any other way to describe it. Over here he's dead, and over here he isn't dead. That's beneficial. So don't go around saying there's no such thing as a beneficial mutation. That's not correct. And if you say that, guess what you're fighting? Facts. And you always lose when you fight facts. But now what we've been learning in more recent days is this. And I want you to listen closely. I said this the other day, but you didn't get it. I know you didn't. The mutation that happened from here to here was a change in the DNA. Remember all that DNA complex? Which caused this change right here phenotypically. The phenotype is what you observe. The genotype is what's in the DNA. Okay? A genotypic change caused a phenotypic change, which caused this thing to survive. What we're learning now is that the change in the gene structure, the DNA, that caused this mutation, that was the mutation, actually caused a loss of information, even though it was beneficial. You with me? So the mutation was beneficial in the sense that this organism survived, but it only survived because it was able to stand up in the face of that particular environment with that particular antibiotic. But it, in the process, lost specificity, is the way it's said in biology, which means it lost information content. Now, I ask you, and it hasn't been proved that every mutation results in a loss of specificity, but it has been demonstrated for a humongous number of them. If it is the case that every mutation causes a loss in specificity, that means you're continually degrading information. How does that help evolution? It's the exact opposite of what evolution needs. So if that's the case, if that becomes demonstrable, and by the way, there's another great source of experimentation. We ought to be experimenting for whether it's true that all mutations result in a loss of specificity. Nobody wants to investigate that. A creationist does. And they keep telling me, you guys don't ever do good science. Will you please fund me and I'll get busy? Nobody will fund a creationist. Not if you tell them you're a creationist. Because they'd be embarrassed. It's ridiculous. We ought to be investigating what happens with mutations. I believe that every mutation results in a loss of specificity. If that's the case, even though it's beneficial, this guy's lost something. And in another environment, he may not be able to adapt to that environment. He may be bumped off easier than that guy. You see what I'm saying? It helped him here, but it didn't help him in the long run. And if this keeps happening, he's going to lose enough specificity. He's going to be a dead duck in a lot of ways. See that? Now, could I have explained this to you before Friday night? I don't think so. I think you've learned a lot since Friday night. You'd have been lost before I started. You've learned enough about this to get the idea. And that's what I want to encourage you. You can read these articles in the newspaper with some matter of discernment now. And I hope you will. And I hope some of you will dig in deeper. And some of you young folks, you become the expert in these fields and you show them. Don't be scared of science. You jump in there with both feet and you learn everything the evolutionist has to teach you. And then you learn all the stuff he doesn't know and show him what's wrong with what he said. You give him back everything he wants. And then you learn everything else too. And glorify God. Maybe that's a good place to stop. It's been good to be with you, everybody. The weekend has been a joy, and thank God you have this group here and all of you from other places. Keep doing all the good you can do for the sake of the Lord. Use your talents for what God has given you to do. and I hope you'll find it. And please remember what we talked about this morning. It's absolutely critical. You want to keep your connection. You keep that connection to God. You find your secret place. God bless you. Who's going to take over here, Jason?